Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, June 5th, 2015. South Sudan's peace talks are set to resume next week. A representative of former detainees says the conflict has brought shame on the country's leaders.
I think it's about time for us as leaders of SPLM to say enough is enough to war and save our people. We have become a pariah in the region, in Africa, and everywhere. We have shamed our people. We have let down our people.
And a look at what Northern Bahar al-Ghazal lawmakers found after investigating how state funds were spent in 2014.
You find that a lot of money collected and not reaching to where it is supposed to go. We found that the state was collecting more than what it would have projected. So then the issue remained, where is the money?
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Talks to restore peace in South Sudan are expected to resume in the Ethiopian capital next week between South Sudan's government and rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar. The last round of talks ended without an agreement in early March. Since then, hundreds of thousands more South Sudanese have been forced from their homes. The economy has crumbled and food insecurity has worsened as the fighting has escalated in parts of the country. Charlton Doki spoke with President Salva Kiir's spokesman, Atenye Wekatenye, about what the game plan is to make next week's talks succeed where earlier rounds have failed.
Atenye says the number of negotiators at the table in Addis Ababa will be greatly reduced from previous rounds of peace talks mediated by regional bloc IGAD.
The peace talks are going to start on the 8th of this month between the two, chief negotiators. Plus other two from each warring party. They will meet in Addis Ababa as six people. From there, what they will agree on is what the IGAD summit of the head of state and governments would actually take and have a summit on South Sudan.
Atenye says he expects the IGAD heads of state summit to be held around June 11th or 12th, but says the exact date has yet to be confirmed.
The summit will be after 10th. Around 11 or 12, has not yet been confirmed. This will be an extraordinary summit for the head of state and government of IGAD. That included the President of Sudan, al-Bashir, President Salva Kiir, President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, President of Somalia, President of Djibouti, and the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Haile Mariam Desalegn.
The talks in Addis Ababa will not include the so-called former political detainees, a dozen high-ranking SPLM members who were detained in Juba in December 2013 when fighting erupted out in the capital. They were accused of plotting a coup against Mr. Kiir and held for several weeks before being released to the custody of officials in Kenya. This week, a group of five former detainees traveled to Juba for talks with President Kiir on unifying the SPLM party. Deng Alor, who led the group, says the former detainees support the IGAD-led effort to end the conflict. He says the former detainees will hold consultations in the next few days with IGAD representatives about the upcoming peace talks between the government and Machar's rebels. He says the 18-month conflict has brought shame on South Sudan's leaders.
I think it's about time for us as leaders of SPLM to say enough is enough to war and save our people. We have become a pariah in the region, in Africa, and everywhere. We have shamed our people. We have let down our people. It is true we got them independence, but unfortunately we took them back to war.
The IGAD process is no longer the only effort to restore peace in South Sudan. South Africa's deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who accompanied the former detainees to Juba, says regional leaders are proposing merging talks that started in Arusha, Tanzania last year to reunify South Sudan's ruling party and the peace talks for South Sudan that IGAD has been leading for nearly a year and a half. They believe that this would move the peace process forward more quickly than just IGAD mediation alone. In nearly 18 months, The IGAD talks have produced a cessation of hostilities pact at the end of January last year, but the deal was violated almost as soon as it was signed. The previous round of IGAD-led talks, which ended on March 6th, were supposed to be the last chance for the warring sides in South Sudan to reach a peace deal. A peace deal that was drafted by IGAD was presented to the warring sides at those talks. But the deadline for ironing out differences over the deal and signing it came and went without an agreement. Since then, the fighting in South Sudan has ground on relentlessly and even picked up steam in recent weeks. Both the government and rebels have said they want to reach a lasting peace deal, but each side points to the other's intransigence over aspects of previous agreements to explain why that peace has remained tragically elusive. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The African Union is also trying to boost the likelihood that this time there will be a peace deal for South Sudan. This week, the African Union, or AU, announced that it has appointed former president of Mali, Alpha Umar Konaré, as its high representative for South Sudan. The head of the AU Commission, Nico Sazazana Dlamini Zuma, said in a statement that Mr. Konaré's appointment is aimed at, quote, further strengthening the AU's contribution towards ending the conflict in South Sudan and the untold suffering inflicted upon the civilian population, end quote. E.J. Hogendorn is the deputy program director for Africa at the International Crisis Group. Hogendorn tells South Sudan and Focus editor Karen Zeitvogel that next week's talks are IGAD's last chance to put a stamp on leading the effort to restore peace in South Sudan.
Well, it's our assessment that this is kind of the last hurrah for the IGAD mediated peace talks on South Sudan. The problem really is that the IGAD talks have lingered on for more than a year and a half now and have really failed to produce a durable agreement. There is actually a lot of jockeying going on at the moment for who will lead the peace process in South Sudan. This event is basically the last hurrah for IGAD, where the facilitators are trying to get these pared-down delegations to agree to a peace deal that has largely been written already. But at the same time, we have another initiative in South Africa. We also have the president of Kenya talking about trying to take control of the process. And subsequently, the AU appointing a special envoy who also has some responsibilities for the peace process in the South Sudan.
Are they talking about also excluding the Troika for South Sudan, the U.S., the U.K., and Norway from the talks? Because I know the government of South Sudan does not want the U.S., the U.K., and Norway present at the talks.
Well, I think it's fair to say that all the parties to the negotiations have their own agenda and are trying to push that forward by excluding people they believe don't share that and trying to get allies on board. When it comes to this IGAD meeting, there has always been a bit of tension between the IGAD member states who control the mediation process and the so-called Troika, who are funding a large part of this process but are, to some degree, prevented from participating in the day-to-day negotiations. Because of the stalling of this process, there's been an attempt to try to create something called an IGAD Plus, which by implication would include more actors. But again, no one has agreed yet on who would actually be involved in IGAD Plus, what exactly it would look like, and who would be leading that process.
So what can be done this time to try to make the talks actually succeed?
Well, it's our assessment that actually the negotiations have gone quite far in terms of bridging many of the divides between the different parties. The main challenge, in our view, is actually divisions within IGAD itself, particularly between Sudan and Uganda, over the deal and who would have more control over the parties in South Sudan.
So why does that division, that difference between Sudan and Uganda exist? Are people jockeying for position from outside of South Sudan and thinking that when there is peace, that they might have a bigger slice of the cake, if you like?
Certainly, what is happening is that there's a lot of neighboring interests and influence in South Sudan, and particularly in the conflict. Uganda has firmly sided with the government, has in fact deployed a lot of troops who have fought with the government. And at the same time, Sudan has sided largely with the SPLA in opposition. That rivalry for influence, both in the conflict and potentially afterwards, is making it very difficult for IGAD to come up with an agreement that all the facilitators can accept, and then all the parties are asked to adhere to.
That was E.J. Hogendorn of the International Crisis Group speaking earlier today with Karen Zeitvogel about the upcoming peace talks in Addis Ababa. Lawmakers in northern Bahar el-Ghazal state have been taking a close look at how billions of dollars in state revenues were spent over the past year. A four-member committee set up by the state legislature a month ago has made some surprising findings, as we hear from Abraham Agoth for VOA in a wheel.
Northern Bahar el-Ghazal state had nearly 200 billion South Sudanese pounds of state revenues in the past fiscal year. But lawmakers were unsure of where the money went, so they set up an audit committee to look into the matter. During a news conference this week, audit committee member Gerang Zakaria said he and his fellow investigators found that most of Northern Bahar el-Ghazal's government institutions failed to accurately account for their spending. Gerang says the auditors suspect most of the state revenues collected last year went into the pockets of officials instead of being used for service delivery or infrastructure projects.
You find that a lot of money collected are not reaching to where it is supposed to go. We found that the state was collecting more than what it would have projected. So then the issue remains, where is the money?
One of the focuses of the audit committee has been to try to find out what happened to $1.2 million that the National Ministry of Finance loaned to former caretaker governor Kwela Gwirikwil. The money was supposed to have been spent on vehicles for state officials, but the audit committee says not all of it was used.
The committee found that only $1,037,000 was used to purchase 24 cars, according to the document we have seen, and then the rest, 163,000, will remain in the estates and used solely by the former caretaker governor.
Gerang says the assembly plans to summon a number of individuals suspected of being involved in the alleged misappropriation of funds. He says the people who will be questioned include the state government ministers and ordinary citizens.
There are so many people involved, people collecting money, people, you know, trying to send money to the finance and money not reaching there. So after this one, the House will summon a number of people whom the report is showing that they have a responsibility for a certain amount of money.
It is not clear if the former caretaker governor, Kwela Gwir, will be among those summoned. Northern Bahar el-Ghazal lawmakers voted to impeach Quill in January, accusing him of corruption, nepotism, abuse of power, and embezzlement. Quill refused to step down and was fired in April by President. For VOA News, this is Abraham Agoth reporting in a wheel.
A citizens' council is accusing Jonglei State's Akobo County Commissioner of corruption. The Anuak Coordination Council in the diaspora wants Commissioner Timothy Taban Juch sacked effective immediately for allegedly mismanaging Akobo County's administration. Jacob Pacek has this report for VOA from Juba.
The Akobo Anuak Coordination Council in diaspora is a non-partisan community organization that monitors developments in Akobo County from Afar. The Anuak is one of the several tribes living in Akobo County. 13 of the council members Skyped with each other on Saturday to discuss their concern about Akobo County Commissioner Taban Juch and agreed to send a letter to Jonglei State Caretaker Governor John Kong asking him to remove Juch from office. Juch was elected as a national member of parliament in 2010 during Sudan general election and was appointed Akobo County Commissioner in 2014. The head of the Akobo Annual Council, Ongyo Nyigo, said it is illegal for Juch to hold both positions at once.
To ban Juch without resigning from his position, he come in Jongle and he become a commissioner again. Without son and daughter of Akobo County and without Anuak as well. So this is against law and this is not right.
You said he done nothing illegal, but people in the diaspora have every right to present their grievances. He said his commissionership position was demand from the people of South Sudan and not his personal ambitions.
It was the leadership who proposed me to go to Akobo because of this crisis, to talk to the community, to tell them exactly what the rebellion means and where should they stand as their representative in the National Legislative Assembly. I was consulted and I accepted the request to help and try to identify my role within the community. By that, those who wanted me to resign, I think I can just express it as illegal.
James Okal, a former chairperson of the annual community in Akobo, said they want a new commissioner.
My reaction is that this man should be removed because he is doing mischief. He is deceiving us for so long. Why should he do that? He has been elected to the National Legislative Assembly. At the same time, he left this National Legislative Assembly and again illegally appointed as a commissioner of Akobo. This is against the constitution of the Republic of South Sudan.
Nyigua blamed the national and state government for the mistreatment of Anuak community in Akobo County, saying Nuer officials have denied them access to health facilities and education. It says many indigenous Akobo County residents are still living in the Panyindu refugees camp in western Ethiopia.
Akobo is belongs to Akbar, it's not belong to Nuer. And since South Sudan become independent, Nuer, they're only holding all those positions. There is no single Anuak who representing the Akobo.
The caretaker governor did not answer our calls for comment. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek from Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. African women say they've heard enough talk about women in government. Now it's time for action. That story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What animal are you most afraid of and why?
The animal that I'm most afraid of is the snake because of its poison and because of its biblical history of Garden of Eden.
Me, I fear that one, pussycat. It doesn't look well for me. I fear it.
Animal that I'm most afraid of, human being as the animal. Most sophisticated animal, the best and the bad. Yes, you cannot hide from that animal.
The animal that I'm most afraid, I can say, is the lion. Yeah, because the lion is so dangerous, but he strays, he's so courageous. Because if the lion does target you, you are in his target. It's impossible for you to get out of it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. While African women have made considerable gains in the political, economic, and social development of the continent, some say they are still widely marginalized within government. The African Union has declared 2015 the Year of Women's Empowerment and Development toward Africa's Agenda 2063. But many women say it's time to put public declarations into practice. Mariama Diallo has more from Washington.
Women are empowered throughout the fabric of Rwandan society and even make up 64% of the parliament, says Rwandan ambassador to the United States, Mathilde Mukantabana.
Primary and secondary schools are free. It means that once you give them that strong beginning, then you are with the other programs at the higher level of university and professional education. Women are as competing as men. So we have women who are now flying the high skies in my country.
But Mukantabana says in other parts of Africa, women remain excluded from social, economic, and political power by a lack of education and the inability to own and inherit property.
For me, women's right is human rights. That's the bottom line.
Empowering women benefits an entire nation, says Mozambique's ambassador to the U.S., Amelia Matosumbana, who also stresses that it cannot be accomplished without men's help.
Why? Because in our societies in Africa, you know that the society is male-dominated. And if we don't have men working along with us, we can have much more difficulties than what we are having now. It's fortunate that men are becoming much more sensitive to the gender issues.
For that reason, laws alone will not bring enough change, says Kamisa Kamara with the National Endowment for Democracy.
Opinion, the structural barriers that affect women on the African continent and elsewhere also, mostly tradition, religion, patriarchy, etc., are barriers that can only be addressed through a change in mentality.
That change is key, the ambassadors say, because full development cannot happen if half of Africa's population is not fully recognized as equal partners in society. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Men and women took part this week in the annual World Economic Forum on Africa in Cape Town. This year's forum focused on finding ways to ensure the continent's economic growth helps not only investors and business owners, but ordinary Africans as well. VOA's Anita Powell has the story from Johannesburg.
For centuries, the African continent has been seen as an economic battlefield for its rich natural resources. But officials, investors, and business leaders have tried for 25 years to change that mindset at the annual World Economic Forum on Africa. Now the WEF is focused on another goal, making sure that Africa's economic growth impacts hundreds of millions of Africans who struggle to survive in chronic, grinding poverty. Business and government officials from the world's largest economy, the United States, say this year's conference, held this week in Cape Town, has seen a growing awareness of the need for stable and sustainable growth that helps ordinary people as well as investors. Elizabeth Littlefield is president and CEO of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, a U.S. government organization that provides financing for private sector projects. It focuses on initiatives that will lead to greater growth and development, like renewable energy, solar and wind power facilities, and natural gas projects.
We're seeing more and more interest. And one challenge, one of the many challenges, but I would say one that we see on the horizon that I'm quite interested in is how do we make sure that economic growth, which is so powerful in so much of the continent, benefits all of Africans, lifts up livelihoods and improves lives of ordinary Africans as well.
But, says U.S. Trade and Development Agency Director Leocadia Zak, major challenges remain. One is the continent's dire lack of good roads, electrical grids, and other structures needed for strong economic growth. The World Bank estimates that Africa needs investments of at least $93 billion a year to fix these problems.
One of the things that we have heard consistently throughout the past couple of days is that one of the biggest constraints to economic growth on the continent is the lack of infrastructure and the need for infrastructure. And what we've also heard is that one of the constraints to the development of that infrastructure are well-prepared projects.
Infrastructure development can be a tough sell for the profit-hungry investor crowd, as it takes time and massive resources. But Daniela Baluarez, the State Department's Senior Advisor for Development, says she is pleased to hear investors say they are more interested than ever in development projects.
At World Economic Forum in Africa, we've seen that the business community wants to be a part of this as well. You're hearing both businesses and governments speaking about the importance of inclusive growth, the role that private investment can play in addressing energy challenges, agriculture challenges, the opportunity to increase the role of women in the economy and the benefits for growth that has.
The conference ends Friday. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Hundreds of citizens will have a chance to voice their concerns and learn about climate change tomorrow. People are scheduled to meet in 80 countries, and their questions, comments, and opinions will be considered when the next climate change conference is held in Paris in December. VOA's Joe DiCapua has this report.
The citizen consultation and deliberation process is called Worldwide Views. It's an effort to raise awareness about climate change and other issues. Organizers say it's better suited for discussions on environmental matters than traditional surveys or focus groups, and that it will help close the widening gap between citizens and policymakers. Worldwide Views is described as a global citizen consultation that provides decision makers with a unique insight on complex governance issues that are debated and negotiated at global venues, such as the UN. It's been in use for climate conferences since 2009. University of Helsinki adjunct professor Mikko Krask has studied the consultation process. He says while supported by the UN, the consultations are actually organized by the Worldwide Views Initiative.
It's a network of research institutes, environmental and other NGOs, assessment institutes, and maybe some ministries as well. But the coordinator, real coordinator, is Danish Board of Technology that used to be a parliamentarian body that provided advice to Danish Parliament.
The day-long event in 80 countries features groups of 100 randomly selected people discussing major issues facing the climate. Krask says the process is superior to surveys and focus groups because of the high level of ignorance among the public about environmental issues. For example, a poll shows only 44% of Europeans know the meaning of biodiversity. A simple definition is the variety of different types of life found in specific geographic locations. He says, if citizens lack sufficient information, how can you survey their opinions?
Questions and issues of global negotiations are really complicated and not available for publics to start reflecting without any kind of background information. So you cannot survey what folks you think about problems of biodiversity.
So the group meetings will also be used to raise awareness. Professor Krask is co-editor of a new book entitled Governing Biodiversity Through Democratic Deliberation. The book contains evaluations by 30 international researchers on the role of the citizen consultation process in environmental policy.
Questions and issues of global negotiations are really complicated and not available for publics to start reflecting without any kind of background information. So you cannot survey what folks you think about problems of biodiversity.
The book does find some problems with the Worldwide Views consultations. Researchers say the method often relies too heavily on numerical information while ignoring local perspectives. Krask says that since the UN is interested in more democratic decision-making, the local perspectives of different countries should be integrated more closely into global policymaking. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Friday. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you have a peaceful weekend. We leave you with the song Desmadjos with the song Banda. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.